It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimera's Comics. Chimera's is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimera's Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, it's Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. It's Halloween! I love Halloween because I love watching old horror movies. There's so many I haven't seen because I was too much of a wuss to watch any until about college. But there are certain people I always go to, and I find new movies that they made that I love every year. And one of those guys is Vincent Price. I adore Vincent Price ever since I first saw him host the Muppet Show in the 70s. I wanted to talk about him for an hour. And luckily, I knew somebody who knew more than I did, and that's Joel Eisner. You might know Joel as the author of the official Batman Bat Book. It was the first episode guide ever written about the Adam West 1966 series. We talked about that. We talked about that so long that that will be its own episode, and that'll run close to when the Blu-rays come out, which is in November 11th. But during that conversation, he mentioned that as he interviewed Vincent Price about his Egghead appearances, they hit it off, and he became his official biographer. He wrote a book called The Price of Fear, which is the biography of Vincent Price. And so he knows everything there is to know about Vincent Price. I want to know everything there is to know about Vincent Price. So we had this conversation.
He was studying at an art institute called the Courtauld. And that was actually, I think it was France. He was doing stuff in England and France. He was studying art. And he got involved with a place called the Gate Theater. Now, in England, there are two types of theaters. There's the public theater, which is basically like Broadway here, and the Gate Theater, which is basically, it was a private theater club. He said the place was no bigger than somebody's living room. It can only hold like 100 seats, but you'd buy a subscription, and they would try out a lot of different plays that way, a very intimate kind of doing things. And at the time, he was asked to be, now they were doing a production of Chicago. This is before Chicago was the musical. It was a drama show about the 1920s. And he said he was brought in because he knew somebody there to be the American dialect coach, because the people doing the acting had heavy British accents, and he had to teach them how to speak American because it took place in Chicago. That, he said, was the fact that also the British chorus girls that were supposed to be in the show as part of the play, you know, it took place in the show, the theater thing, could not chew gum and speak at the same time without swallowing it. So he had to teach them how to chew gum like the gun mulls do here in you know, the 1920 movies. So he just had that, and then for a bit thing, they gave him a part as a policeman who walks on board on the stage with no lines. It was just a little part of the thing. But for the second show they did, it was a thing based on Queen Victoria. And Queen Victoria was married to Prince Albert. Now, Prince Albert, most people don't know, was a German. He was not British. He was a British nobleman who she married. So most of the descendants of the British family now are half German. So he got to play. The reason why he got the part, partly because it was a small theater club, partly because he looked like Prince Albert a lot, and he also spoke German. So he got the part, and the play was a big hit. I forget the name of the British actress who played the part of Queen Victoria. But at the time, there was a big American producer who named Gilbert Miller, very popular producer back in the 1930s. And his main leading lady was Helen Hayes, who at that time in the 1936, 37, was early in her 30s already. And she was a bigger star on Broadway. And she was a very petite little woman, about 5 foot tall, 5 foot one, perfect size for Queen Victoria. And he came over to England, and he saw the play, and he bought it to bring it back to Broadway for Helen Hayes. And then, he not only that, he wanted to bring Vincent over to play Prince Albert, thinking he's a British actor. You know, because usually they start the show with the British actors and they leave, and then American actors take over the part once it's been established.
Right.
When they found out he's American, they say, perfect, because now I don't have to find another leading man when this guy would normally leave. So So he arranged to have Vincent come over, and he worked on stage with Helen Hayes for his first acting job. Excuse me. And he never had an acting lesson in his life.
Wow.
He was a natural in that way. He was a bit of a ham, but he was a natural. Then when he was on Broadway, he got many different offers from motion picture studios, because back then in the middle of the 1930s, most of the silent actors, their voices were unusable for the pictures, and other ones really weren't current. So they were always taking the actors really from the stage to act on screen in front of the cameras, because at that time, cameras were very stodgy in their movements, and they shot things, a lot of things like a stage play. So he got offers from, MGM, Paramount, a couple other studios, to do his first movie. And Helen Hayes said, don't take it. You don't have enough experience. Back in the 1930s, Broadway theater did not have air conditioning. That's why the theater season is very strange. The theater season starts in the fall. It ends in March or April. That's why they had a thing called summer stock, where all the big-name actors would go out on tour up in the mountains, in Connecticut, wherever they would go, and do like a play a week and be a big star and then, do the particular things. So he said, go out and do as many plays as you can do in summer stock, which he did, and he built himself up a reputation that way. So now he knew how to do, he was only doing one big play, and it's the only part he knows how to play. So then when he came back the following season, he got an offer again from the studios. In this case, it was Universal. And then she told him she'd take the offer. And he had it in his contract that he'd be able to come back to Broadway in between motion pictures for a certain amount of time. Of course, motion pictures were taking a long time to make them, so he never really got a chance to opt into that contract. He did two pictures at Universal, which were The Tower of London, starring Basil Rathbone and Boris Karloff, in which he played the part of the Duke of Clarence. It's the story of Richard III. It's more of a gothic melodrama than it is a horror picture, but they added Boris in the picture as this bald-headed, club-footed executioner named Maud, who was basically Basil Rathbone's henchman who would go around killing people for him.
And what year is this?
1939. It was made in late 38. All right. It came out in 39.
So Karloff had already made both Frankensteins.
Frankenstein was 31. He was their biggest star they had at that time. And Rathbone had just come off doing Captain Blood a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and working with Errol Flynn. So now he's playing this big melodrama. It's a Shakespearean story, the way they wrote this thing up. And there's some interesting people in the picture who want to do a little bit parts here and there, but including the one, I always remember this as a joke, the guy who performed the voice of Sherman in Peabody and Sherman cartoon later on for Jay Ward, a guy by the name of Walter Tetley, actually had a small part in the movie as a chimney sweep. And you hear the voice coming out of this guy, and I say, well, that's Sherman, and you realize, but he was like one of those guys who was very short, and his voice never changed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of our pictures. But in the picture, there's a very funny scene between Basil and Boris and Vincent. They decided to have a drinking contest. So who could drink the most wine without passing out first? And the thing about it was that they weren't drinking wine. They were drinking diluted Coca-Cola. So it looked like wine, but it was diluted, so of course there was no gas in it. And they got to the point, both of them were drinking so much of it, because they got doing retakes, they were getting nauseous from this stuff. And it was just so much, they got so sick of it, they didn't want to see Coca-Cola anymore. They're supposed to drown him. His character drowns in a vat of wine. So Vincent, being new to pictures, he said, I'll do it. He didn't know what they were stuntmen, what they were going to do. But they said to him, okay, fine, you want to do this? Okay, we're going to open the big vat, they're going to throw you in. There's a bar built into the bottom of the vat. When they throw you in, sort of push yourself down to the bottom, hold on to that bar so that you're on the bottom so your feet are not sticking up, and then they close the lid on you. And you do it a count of 10, and then you get out. He said, okay, fine. He didn't know, what he should have done about it, but he thought it was going to work. Well, they throw him in. He goes down to the bottom. Now, of course, there's one other thing I have to point out is that Basil and Boris were using the vat as a garbage dump. So there's lots of Coke bottles floating around in there, and cigarette butts, and who knows what else that had sunk to the bottom of the vat. You didn't see it on top when he went in. So the water wasn't clean anymore. So he's down there anyways, and then they slam the lid down on top, and then, of course, it's part of the scene. Boris jumps on top of it and sits on top of the vat. They finish the scene, And then the two of them go off. And then what happens is somehow Boris jammed the back lid down. He couldn't get out. They had to come in with fire axes to break the thing open to get him out of there. After, he turns out he's all right, they dried him off. He got a huge round of applause from everybody in the cast and the crew for doing the host stunt. The only thing was he noticed was that Boris and Basil were gone. They left. He said, some friends they are. well, and a couple minutes later, the two of them come back with a wrapped carton of Coca-Cola with a big bow on it for it as a prize. Then the next picture Vincent did for Universal is The Invisible Man Returns. It was also the debut of Alan Napier, who was Alfred the Butler on Batman. Right. So he was working with Alfred 26 years before Batman.
And that's so funny because I never saw The Invisible Man Returns, but I had always wondered in the end of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
That's Vincent.
He does a voiceover as The Invisible Man, and I always wondered why it was him and not Claude Rains. I had no idea that he played him in the sequel.
Now, the biggest thing about this film that Vincent always brought up was the fact is that back in 1939-40 when they made it, the special effects, when there was no green screen, there was no superimposition or anything else, they would do a very interesting process by draping everything in black velvet over the whole set, you see. And then they would film it. And then the actor would come in playing the Invisible Man, also all dripped head to toe in black velvet, looking sort of like a ninja, I guess. And then what would happen is they'd superimpose him over the other footage. It was like one footage in front of the other footage, and the black velvet would cause things to vanish. And so what happened was there's a very famous scene in the picture where he's walking around. Of course, he doesn't wear any clothes. You don't see it, but that's the way he becomes invisible. Is that he gets cold, it's freezing outside, he finds the scarecrow out in the field somewhere, and he has to undress the scarecrow and put the scarecrow's clothes on himself. And he said it took forever to do this. In fact, it took about 8 or 9 hours, he said, to do about a 3-minute scene. Because what happens was if you moved your hand in the wrong direction, in front of the velvet or something, your hand would be seen. So you had to stay within the black velvet area of this particular shot. And to dress yourself, he had to take the clothes off the scarecrow without getting seen, and then put them on himself on top of the black velvet he was wearing in order to make the effect visible. That would he like. And then his one of the other favorite pictures he did was one of the worst pictures he ever made. And he's very proud of it. It's called Green Hell. The thing why they all wanted to do the picture was directed by James Whale, who directed Frankenstein.
Right.
But by 1940, Whale's career was already on the way out. And it turns out that Vincent said that Whale lost it. He didn't know. He just couldn't keep the picture going. But the set, and I told this to Seth Fairbanks, and he was fascinated by this, they built this huge temple for the Mayan Indians that they were using it for, including like a big, it looked like a llama. It was supposed to be like a llama, a big thing built into this temple with a gigantic altar stone and everything was there. And it was a very dark movie. You really couldn't see much of it. But the set was later reused, maybe a few months later, in the first of the Khoris the Living Mummy pictures, as the Egyptian temple from the mummy's hand, where George Zuko was trying to sacrifice the girl before Khoris comes and stops him. Mm-hmm. And you get to see the full temple. They reused the set for the mummy pictures for a couple of years, so there was always reused the set. The rest of the film was horrible. It was deemed, actually, I think he said it was Harvard. Was it Harvard? I think he said it was Harvard's top 10 worst films ever made at that time period, and he was very proud of that one. You know, that's the kind of thing Vincent would do. I mean, he did another picture called The House of the Seven Gables, which was the where he played George Sanders' brother. He did a lot of pictures with Sanders. And that was based on the Hawthorne story. And the hero in that one was, of course, Dick Foran, who was the hero in The Mummy's Hand, so the mummy creation. And Alan Napier was in there, too. He was a regular Universals. Now, Vince, I should point out, in between all this, was actually had been a member of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater.
I didn't know that.
Back then. Yes. He was one of the only members of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater back in 19, after he left doing the Victoria Regina show, which was the Queen Victoria thing, and so 1937, 38, before he started doing his movies, he did two plays with Orson Welles, mm-hmm. Shoemaker's Holiday and Heartbreak House. He was in the group there with Joseph Cotten,
right.
And Everett Sloan and Agnes Moorehead and all these other people.
So this is just a little before Orson does War of the Worlds on the radio.
This was before he did Orson. This is when he was doing his. They had a theater.
Right.
And they would do like plays. They would, you know, like 50, 60, you know, performances. It was in a little theater group thing. And he was part of that, but he said that was the worst problem working with Orson Welles was he never showed up for rehearsals. And he came into the show, he didn't know his lines. He was completely unprepared. It's just, he was such an impresario doing what he was doing, and he was all mixed up. However, Orson was very nice to him because during that time period, man, Vincent was had gotten engaged to his first wife, Edith Barrett, who was also, she also became a member of the theater group. And they were married at a local church in Manhattan, and then they had the reception at Orson's theater.
Huh.
And he had all these big, because of Orson Welles, he had all these big theater critics and famous Shakespearean classical actors, all these people showing up at his wedding because of this. So it was a big theatrical event. And so that was a little part of his life that way. After that, Universal got into financial trouble, and they wound up canceling everybody's contracts, not renewing anybody. And the studio was eventually bought out from the Lemley family, and it was taken over and changed. So he wound up working eventually, let's see, 42. He went over to Fox, and he started doing some of his better pictures that he remembers, his big classical epic pictures like Song of Bernadette, the girl who saw the mother of Jesus at Lourdes, where they created, you know, this healing waters. It's a French, it took place in France in the 1850s or 60s, I remember. And he was a town prosecutor. And so that was one of his big, you know, he was doing a big classical type pictures. He did another picture called Brigham Young Frontiersman, where he played Joseph Young, the founder of the Mormon Church. Vincent's other big picture he did in the 40s, which was the other thing that made his career, was a picture called Laura for him. And it was with Joseph Cotten and Jean Tierney, and it was directed by Otto Preminger, another Mr. Freeze. He's got Batman going through his whole career.
Wow, yeah.
And, well, in it, he played this little upper-class scum kind of thing, and Laura, they had this big famous song that was made out of the picture, and it's one of his most favorite pictures because he's playing all kind of sleazy people in this film. That's one of the things he's proud of. But in between that, something else happened to Vincent's career, which really, you know, up until this point, even when he did his Invisible Man picture, he was wrongly accused. He wasn't the murderer. He was the Invisible Man because he had to, you know, run from the police. He was a good guy in Tower of London. He was a good guy in every other picture he basically played. He wound up going to Broadway during 1941 season in a play called Angel Street. Now, Angel Street is not known by Angel Street anymore. It's called Gaslight. The play opened in December of 1941, December 7th.
Oh, wow.
And... yeah, well, that was the interesting thing, and that was the only play that when the, you know, this was during the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But because of the time difference between Hawaii and New York, you know, nobody knew really what was going on. Of course, there was no television or anything else. And after the play came out that night, it was a huge hit. They got great reviews and all this other stuff. Vincent was so full of himself as far as this big hit he finally had on himself. His wife was in California, and he was calling to talk to his wife in California, and she goes, you know, and talking about, you know, he was saying, you know, did you hear about this great, you know, this big, you know, what was it? It's like this big thing that happened, you know, on Broadway kind of thing. And she started talking about, you know, what are you talking about? It's like, you know, is it the play? Because, well, did you hear about the bombing? You know, he was so busy looking for his reviews, he never looked at the front of the newspaper. And he was like, it's this big thing. He said, yeah, the big thing is me. No, it's really the big thing is you. It's the war. You know, he had no clue what was going on.
I didn't bomb at all. What are you talking about?
No, the big bomb. It was a big thing. You know, but the play ran for 2 years. He left. Vincent, in his career, he has worked with almost every single horror film great, except one, and that's Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, well, because Abner Costello Meet Frankenstein, he's only a voiceover.
He did the voiceover after the film was finished.
Right.
They needed someone to dub the voice, and he happened to be at Universal at the time. He never met Lugosi. He never saw Lugosi. The funny thing is Lugosi came several years later as a publicity stunt to the opening of House of Wax with a guy in a gorilla suit on a chain. House of Wax was a B-movie. It was a remake of a 1933 Lionel Atwill film called The Mystery of the Wax Museum he did with... Atwill was the crazy sculptor, and Fay Wray was in it from King Kong. And that was a sort of semi-remake of a 1920s picture called Waxworks. But Vincent, to me, was never a horror actor. He had no history outside of the Invisible Man picture, which I said, they even made him a choice for the lead in that particular film as playing this guy who was burned and built his face out again out of wax and is sort of this tormented creature underneath. But I guess they wanted somebody suave with the kind of personality who could pull up both parts. But he never really had any kind of experience in that area. He wasn't like back then, he wasn't like a Karloff or a Claude Rains, who was doing the Phantom of the Opera several years before. He could pull that off with the makeup and things. But Vincent was pulled into it. He offered him the part. The interesting part about the film, which to Vincent was always the funniest part about the film, was the director by the name of André de Toth. He was a Hungarian immigrant who directed a lot of big pictures in his country, and over here in this country did some different things. The thing about André de Toth was he had only one eye. He was blind in the other eye.
And they had to make a 3D picture.
They had to make a 3D picture. That was the funny part of the whole thing. I wore an eye patch. And Vincent thought that was so funny, you know, because here it goes. But you see, he did something that's why this picture survived. Unlike many other 3D pictures where they spend most of the picture throwing things at the screen, mm-hmm. hoping to make big use of the 3D effects, he used the story as the plot and only put some 3D effects in just to carry it through.
There's that scene, the first time I ever saw it on AMC, and I didn't know it was a 3D picture. And in the middle of the picture, there's just a guy with a paddle ball for about two or three minutes.
Well, he is a real person. In fact, he died not that many years ago. He was a real character. He was actually an expert on those things. They hired him for that part.
Yeah.
And the parts in the picture where he's actually talking to the audience, he's talking to people around him in the film, and he's actually talking to the audience, I'm going to put the ball into your bag of popcorn, watch
yeah, exactly.
your ear. Yeah, he was a real quite character. He's actually, you can find him online on the Internet Movie Database. But they actually created that thing for the film to make use of the 3D effect. But everything else was a murder mystery script based on the original movie from 1933, and they carried it through that way. That's why you can watch it flat, because he was working without using the effects in that particular sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to him, was a big popular. And he loved to do some of it. Some of the other things, as far as after the film was made and it came out, he was on Broadway doing some play or something. He was in New York. And he used to love to sneak into the theater where they were playing House of Wax next door and sit in the back of the audience. He used to like to sit behind young girls. You know, not little kids, but you know, like women in their early 20s. And they said they get to the scene at the end of the picture where he falls into the vat of wax and he's, you know, it's all bubbling, the steam coming all over the thing. And after the film comes up, he leans over to them and he goes, "Did you like it?" And they would jump out of their seats because here he was sitting in the back of the theater with nobody recognized him with the 3D glasses on.
And that eventually is how the Tingler ends.
In a sense, yes. Vince, I have to point out something about Vincent Price. The one thing most people were not aware about him, I mean, everyone knows he was, to some degree, he was an art expert, he was an art collector, mm-hmm. he was a cook, he wrote cookbooks, he did book on wine, he did all kind of different things cultural-wise. He came from an upper-middle-class family in St. Louis, Missouri. He's not even British, as people think he is. And so he's had a much bigger up. His father owned the National Candy Company. It used to make jawbreakers and all kind of candy for confections. So he was always, you know, in money, but he always fancied himself a slapstick comedian.
Hmm.
He never was. See, the price of the name of my book is called "The Price of Fear."
Mm-hmm.
The film career of Vincent Price, in his own words, but "The Price of Fear" refers to the fact of what he had to do, not to mention his own name, Price, what he had to do to keep himself working in show business. He basically had to sell himself out. This was the price he had to pay to be involved with Fear Pictures. Or he didn't like horror pictures. He liked him and Boris supposed to prefer to as terror films or things of that nature because they liked to scare people. It wasn't horror. And to him, he always would. It started with House of Wax. There was some humor in the picture. He always did these little wonderful little things. I remember the woman faints and he goes smelling salts. You know, mm-hmm. He did these little bits and pieces of things he would do. He was very good at doing the comedy stuff. And he always loved to send up his image on anything he would do. He was a very good friend of Red Skelton, and he did many appearances on his TV show. He did appearances on the Jack Benny show, and he would do all sorts of radio shows.
Yeah, one of my favorites was, as a kid, I grew up seeing Vincent Price mostly on television. I remember his Muppet Show really, really vividly.
Yes.
He's in the first season of that, and it's all sending up his image.
And half of it, he's not even in. It's all the Monster Muppets. They got a chance to use it, but he loves sending
right.
that stuff up. he would do what people remember him for. I'm going to go back to the film thing in a second. Of course, later on in the 60s, of course, it was Egghead on Batman, which he loved to do because it was a campy thing, which he loved to do. That and his other thing people remember him for was his episode of The Brady Bunch.
Yeah.
As the crazy archaeologist in Hawaii. And so he loved doing that. And he did a lot of the Carol Burnett shows, and he did the Lucy episode, and he did and all sorts of wonderful things, sending up his image. He always wanted to kill his image as a horror actor, which so many other actors have tried over the years. He managed to do it.
Now, was he just trying to show his range, or was he not happy doing so many horror pictures?
Well, you know, for someone, as he said, who was raised in classical theater and the classical movies in the 1930s and 40s, and it came to the 1950s, and Marlon Brando and James Dean and the other big actors who came from the method theater acting, came onto the screen. Everybody was mumbling and everybody was doing all kind of stuff. He said people like him and Basil Rathbone and all these other people who were classically trained per se, wound up doing costume pictures, you know, pirate films and the musketeer pictures.
Yeah, larger than life things.
Yeah, and that's what he did because that was the only way someone like that would do over the top kind of performances. Now, after House of Wax came out, he was bombarded by dozens of offers to do horror pictures, murder mystery pictures, things. He turned them all down. He didn't want to do it. Most of the stuff was low-budget stuff. And I remember by this point, late 1950s, Lugosi was almost sick and dying. He died in 56. Karloff got out of it. He was already doing television stuff, a lot of TV stuff and radio stuff and children's stories and records and other things he was doing. And Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee were not yet doing the Dracula Frankenstein pictures.
Yeah, the Hammer pictures.
That hadn't started the resurgence of horror pictures yet. And even Lon Chaney was doing westerns. And Peter Lorre was doing like these murder mystery things that came up, and you know they weren't really doing much in the way of horror because back in the 50s, you got to remember, this was the nuclear age stuff. Everything from Godzilla to giant bugs, you know. So a right. lot of that and spaceship stuff and Captain Video and television. So
he does The Fly around this time.
His next big thing, he said he wanted. He was working. I think with a favorite actually of Howard Hughes. He had a contract at RKO. To do a few pictures there, including direct a picture, which he never got to do because what happened? You sold the studio. But he used to love it because he was doing things like Son of Sinbad and Baghdad and all these little costume pictures he was doing. And one of the things was he said that Hughes, for some reason, took a liking to him. And on the set of one of the pictures, Hughes was at the time in Las Vegas, and he used to call Vincent every day on the phone. And Hughes was a bit of a character, and he used to call Vince on the phone and ask him. No, this was before he really went nuts, and ask him, you know, to tell him whatever dirty jokes he had heard on the set the day before. And the funny part was, he said by that time Hughes was half deaf, so he had to scream it into the phone so everybody heard him. Vince's biggest picture in the 50s, before he got to his horror pictures, was the Ten Commandments.
Already is in the Ten Commandments.
He's Baca, the master builder, the one that Charlton Heston murders to save Joshua. Vincent actually did that with Judith Anderson, and she had worked with Vincent in the picture Laura. And they were both, you know, offered the things to do. And since he called her up on the phone, he said, "What do you think? You want to do a, you know, a DeMille picture?" And she said, "You don't make it in Hollywood unless you do a DeMille film." So they both agreed to be in it. She was the slave who was working for Ann Baxter, who was. Again, Olga, Queen of the Cossacks. Some of these people seem to sort of follow him around, all these people with the background.
It sounds like just from these stories is that Vincent was just kind of in the right place at the right time always.
In a sense, yes. He was just sort of offered weird things. It was very strange.
Yeah, I mean, he was always good. You know, he certainly wasn't a hanger-on. But
Vincent would say he never made it as a big A-list star. He was always sort of a character actor, B-list actor. So he was able to get a lot of different parts and a lot of do a lot of different things. He was supposed to be locked into one type of film, like a John Wayne picture. Now, in the Ten Commandments, he gets killed off about 45 minutes into the film. The thing runs 3.5 hours.
Right.
But he's in the scenes with Cedric Hardwick and Yul Brynner and Charlton Heston and John Derrick and a couple other people. And it's an interesting thing about this picture. I've never been able to find out whatever happened to the rest of the footage. I spoke to Charlton Heston about this when I wrote the book years ago, the interview with him.
Wow.
Vincent used to tell a story where, I don't know if there's one big scene they have is like Senior Carter goes to find out why Charlton Heston's character didn't come visit him. He says, I'm too busy building your city, and I can't come, so he goes to visit him. And Yul Brynn is there, and of course he's vying for favor with the father, and Vincent's there, sort of the architect who was building the pyramids and the statues and things. And there's a scene where Vincent says, you know, when Caesar Hardwick comes, yonder lies the valley, the city of Seti's glory. Seti was Hardwick's character. And it's all blue screen. There's nothing there. Completely nothing there. I mean, they're building it at a direct blue screen. And Vincent said, you know, and they said, Vincent, you're not seeing this a lot of conviction. He says, I don't even know what I'm talking about. He goes, all right. And so DeMille took him and all the rest of them to the screening room, showed them all the footage they filmed actually in Egypt and put that on the screen. They changed his whole performance. Now, if you go back and look at that screening performance, he doesn't say those lines. Heston does. Huh. Slightly different version of it. For this day, Vincent was always talking about that particular sequence. So I said, I got to talk to Heston about this. So I agreed, I talked to him. He did the interview with me. We talked for a few minutes on phone. And he said, and I read him the whole scene that Vincent goes, I remember the scene. He said, it was cut. He said, there's a longer version of the movie that hasn't survived. Back in the days of the 50s and the 60s, they did a thing where they referred to as a roadshow version of a film. They did that for that...
It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, I remember.
Mad World did that, yes, and there was the Western one they did. When the West was won. How the West was won. Yeah. They made a few other pictures, like Around the World in 80 Days had that also. They take this picture, they shoot a long version of the film, and they take it out and do it on a big screen somewhere, in some small town somewhere, a few things here and there. Sort of basically like screening, and then they cut the film to make it shorter, to see where the audience was too restless or it didn't work or whatever. They were trying it out of town, so to speak, on these big epic pictures, and they would do that because it was a big CinemaScope film.
Yeah, so it's like focus grouping it while it's
exactly,
already out.
Exactly. But they filmed all this and said, what are we going to put? People are going to sit through this for 4 or 5 hours. Well, you know, they have to cut something out. And that scene was cut out, and they reshot it, apparently, with Heston doing that piece. Sort of. There's a whole other piece that's missing. Before he got involved with the Fly, he got involved with my favorite picture he's ever done, and that was The House on Haunted Hill.
Oh, yeah.
That was William Castle's best picture, I think, of all the things he'd done at that point. It was an independent picture. He did it for Allied Artists. He had stumbled on a rainy night into a coffee shop somewhere in Hollywood. And sitting in the coffee shop alone was Vincent. Now, he had this idea for the script for The House on Haunted Hill, where he becomes this millionaire who invites these people to the house, and people start getting killed off by ghosts. And the Castle was quite a showman. He was quite he walked right up to Vincent and said, here, I'm a big producer, and I've got this movie script, and I think you'd be interested in this particular thing. And he tells him the story. Vincent said, he sounded interested. Sit down, I'm interested. So he saw something that Vincent told him. He said he was supposed to do a Western opposite Jimmy Stewart. He always wanted to do a Western. He did Bounder, Arizona, which is a pseudo-Western. Admittedly, it wasn't a Western. He did a comedy Western for Universal called The Curtain Call at Cactus Creek, which is really a run with Donald O'Connor, Walter Brennan, and Eve Arden. But he played other Shakespearean actors, but he's always playing those characters. But he really wanted to do this Western. Now, Vincent was 6'3", and Jimmy Stewart was almost about the same size. Unfortunately, Jimmy Stewart got sick. They had he had to bow out of the picture, and they recast the part with Alan Ladd, who was about 5'4".
Huh.
Very short man. So they couldn't have him constantly looking up at the villain, so they recast Vincent's part. I don't know what happened to them. I don't know if they made the movie or not, but Vincent, he was very disappointed he lost out on this picture. And then he just stumbled upon Castle, and Castle offered the script, said he'll do it. And that was the beginning of Vincent's real venture into horror pictures. But again, he wasn't the villain. He was a multimillionaire who was married to a wife who was having an affair with a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And her and the psychiatrist were trying to bump him off in the house, blaming him on the ghosts. And he, of course, they invited other people, they're sort of witnesses, and they had my very favorite character actor, Alicia Cook, was in it, as the guy who owned the house, who's a drunk, who always thought the house was out to get everybody. And they talk about people got killed in the house, and they did a couple of pictures with Vincent later, but...
Yeah, Place is more of a murder mystery than a...
It is a murder mystery, because at the end you find out that the wife and the boyfriend were trying to kill him, and he knew about it, so he actually arranged so they were killed instead.
Yeah, and it, o- why, and it, It opens almost like a Twilight Zone. He's almost Rod Serling, where he's talking directly to the camera and introducing the characters.
Well, it actually, if you ever see the trailer for it, it goes even one step further. In the film, it goes, "I'm Frederick Lauren, and I'm inviting people to the house on Haunted Hill." Mm-hmm. And they also, so they put up all the heads of the other people coming in. There's Alicia Cook saying, "I'm watching Pritchard, I own the house. And my brother killed his wife here," and all this other stuff with these ghosts. In the trailer, he goes, "I'm Vincent Price inviting you to the house on Haunted Hill." You know, when you'll see disembodied heads and ghosts, and he goes, and the last line of that one is, "Well, don't be late to your own funeral." But as Vincent said, the title doesn't mean anything. House on Haunted Hill. The hill is haunted, not the house. You know. But it was basically a murder mystery. But at the end, of course, my favorite line, of course, now that there's two more ghosts, now that they're coming for him and then they're going to come for you. It was a little spooky ending thing to it. Now, his next film was The Fly, and he's screaming, "Help me," with a very high voice, "Help me."
Yeah.
And now, of course, there is no fly in the web. David Henson actually put on the makeup, went into the big fly's web, and they filmed that thing separately. So all they're looking at is sort of a fake spider web in the garden. And Herbert Marshall has got to stand there with Vincent and then hear the fly's voice, and then he picks up the rock and supposedly smashes and kills the fly so he doesn't get eaten by the spider. But in order to do the scene properly, they had somebody off camera doing the fly's voice, the little high-pitched voice. And the two of them couldn't stop laughing. They thought it was hysterical. They said it took them almost a whole day to do that one scene. And eventually, if you go look at the screen of the film, you'll actually, they're almost standing almost back to back when they're doing it because they couldn't look in each other's eyes anymore. And eventually Herbert Marshall yells out, "Help you, help him, help me." They couldn't get through the picture. But it became a big hit, and it was done in color. The director who made the picture died about less than a month before the film came out. So
really?
Kurt Newman. Kurt Newman's last picture, yeah. And it was his biggest hit he ever had, and he died shortly after the film. Now, after that, that was a big hit. That's about 58. Now, 59... we have two more pictures that sort of completed up his whole career. One of which was The Tingler. This 3-foot centipede kind of looking thing.
Yeah, it looks like a spine itself.
They actually found this prop maker who just happened to create this giant worm. And they said, "Let's make a movie around it." That's the whole thing. Yeah, that's where the idea came up from. So they came up with this particular thing, and this thing would crawl across the floor. Now, of course, you could see when this thing was moving, there were wires on it, because it would wiggle, but it was made of rubber. Mm-hmm. And this thing would grab a hold of you, and you really would be strangled by this thing, and you had to scream. And that's the gimmick of William Castle. Again, in the theater, the thing gets loose in the silent movie theater down below, and it gets loose, and you scream for your lives, a tingle is loose in the theater, so everybody has to scream.
Yeah, Castle, the screen goes black.
Yeah, well, in House of Haunted Hill, he had the scene where he was tricking the wife into thinking he died in a vat of acid, and his skeleton was coming out to get after him. So in the film, Vincent's got this giant marionette skeleton puppet scaring the wife, and he pushes her into the acid vat. But in the theater, they had inflatable skeleton mounted in the theater, and when the skeleton came out on the screen, the skeleton flew over the audience. Yeah, but in this particular one, they actually had the thing when the tingle was attacking in the theater. They had certain theaters wired with little motors that would shock people's butts when the thing would happen. Vincent was so anxious to get rid of his horror image, he used to send himself up on all these different sitcoms and dramatic, and he knew a lot of game shows. He did a lot of game shows back in the 60s, and later on he did 900 episodes of Hollywood Squares.
Yeah.
Of which most of them were erased. But... And he would do all these different things, and he would do these different, especially on the Red Skeleton show, all these sketches, these pratfalls and slapsticks, because he loved it, because he had to really change his image. Now, I did a long interview with Sam Arkoff for this book, and we started talking a lot about Vincent and stuff, and they all loved Vincent. That was the one thing I always found. I never found one person who never disliked him. He got along with everybody. By this time, was making guest appearances on a lot more shows. He was doing... they did a couple of comedy pictures with him, which weren't that great, called the Dr. Goldfoot movies.
Oh, right,
Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine, which we know as Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Machine, and a few other titles that kept changing. In fact, in England, they had to call it Dr. G because there was a Dr. Goldfoot in the phone book. Now, they started making pictures in Italy to save money, AIP. And one of the pictures they did was the one you mentioned before, I Am Legend, which is The Last Man on Earth.
Right.
It was a co-production between AIP and one of the Italian studios over there. They had an Italian producer produced a bunch of their pictures for them. But it sat on the shelf for 2 years. It was actually made in like 1962. And it was released over here by IRP. Now, that was originally, a very quick story about that one was, according to Richard Matheson, the picture was supposed to be directed by Fritz Lang.
Really?
Fritz Lang was supposed to direct that picture. At least that's what he was told when they bought the film story to his book. And they said, we're going to get Fritz Lang to direct this thing, and it's going to have a huge budget, you know, and shooting color and this whole big thing. And then they made this deal with it in Italy, and they moved the thing over there, and Fritz Lang backed out. I don't know exactly why he backed out. And they brought in a director by the name of Sidney Salco, who was basically a 50s director. He directed westerns, he directed a few other things. He later spent the rest of his career after that, and I was in the 70s and 80s before he died, teaching a course at one of the universities in California. And the story goes that he used to tell the class that was his favorite picture to direct. That was his masterpiece.
Hmm.
Now, the thing was, is that they were actually weren't even supposed to get Vincent for that picture. They were supposed to get a big name. Who they were supposed to get for that picture? I'd have to look it up offhand. I don't remember. But it was like they were trying to get like some really big name, like a Paul Newman type character for the picture, some big lead. And Vincent, I think, as much as people like that picture, and I do like that picture, I remember seeing that picture years ago for the first time on the ABC late night movie at 1 o'clock in the morning in the summertime on a Sunday night. It's the first time they started running. They got a whole bunch of AIP pictures. It was sandwiched in between a lot of the remakes of Invasion of the Saucer Men and all the other stuff made by a guy named Buchanan in Texas, like the Eye Creatures and all this other stuff, Summer Week. You know? I like the picture. Now, the music from that picture was from other things. It was the music, actually, that was done. Well, actually, the guy who did the music for that did the music for Voyage to Beyond the Sea.
Hmm.
A guy by the name of, it was a team up, and it was, I forget so many things I remember. I can't remember something. Anyway, Paul Sotell, and Bert Sheffield. But Paul Sotell did the music for that, and he used that was the same music. They borrowed that music actually from the Return of the Fly. It was the Return of the Fly music actually is what it was. The theme music. They reused it again. They leased it out.
Wow.
And the film was shot in Rome, except for Vincent, the entire cast was Italian.
Yeah, you can tell when you watch that film.
Well, if you look at it, there's one of the secondary stars, the guy playing the head zombie, if you want,
yeah.
Ben Cortman, was a guy by the name of Giacomo Jack Stuazzi. He used to be known in movies as Jack Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
In most of those 1960s, it was called spaghetti science fiction movies, Wild Planet, War of the Planets, all those little things they shot. They put a couple of odd American actors over there, and they would shoot these things. He became a big action star over there. But everybody was dubbed in. Some of the people were actually talking English, but they were doing it phonetically.
Mm-hmm.
And the soundtrack is really to be, you know, they didn't dub it right. It just comes off in certain talking scenes overdubbed. But
yeah, it's almost like watching a Godzilla film.
Well, it's actually not so much a Godzilla film. The mouths move, and they don't. This is they're like watching the old Hercules pictures.
Mm.
We shot at the same studios, actually, as a lot of the stuff they shot over there, all the Muscle Man films. But the thing about it, Vincent told me, he said there's two things about the picture he remembers. Is he spent a year in Rome making this and two other pictures, which I'll get to in a moment. And he had his wife there, and they went out during, you know, in between pictures, they were doing a lot of it, looking for art and stuff. But one of the things was, he said, the picture was supposed to take place in Los Angeles, and they said there's one place in the world that does not look like Los Angeles, and that's Rome. they spent days in trying to find places that looked anything close to it. But even his house, you know, he was in looked like something out of a, you know, a country scene somewhere.
Yeah, and the church where they ended is,
yeah.
There's nowhere in America that looks like that church.
The other thing was, he said that they filmed that picture, it was supposed to be the summertime, actually, in a sense, almost, I think. So they filmed that picture in March of 62, and it was freezing.
Hmm.
And he had to run around in shirt sleeves and without a jacket, okay, just a suit jacket, and he said, and it was so cold. He said he used to tip the driver of his limousine to keep the engine running, so in between scenes he'd go inside the car and warm up.
Wow.
Yeah, he said he used to, you know, it was that kind of picture. My personal feeling about the film is I like the film, but I actually think Vincent was miscast. He was under contract for AIP, so they put him in the picture over there because it's part of his films for his contract, because he was in a contract for a long time with them. I think he was miscast because There are certain scenes, I have to point out, Vincent is not the action movie star.
No.
That Charlton Heston turned it into in the Omega
Man. Right, in the Omega Man, and then again they remake it with Will Smith.
Well, you know, Arkoff told me that they actually had to come to him because he owned the rights to the book to make Omega Man. They had to lease the rights from him to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually were, you know, it wasn't like went back to Mathis, and they actually, Arkoff was responsible for giving the rights. But Vincent, there's a scene in the film where the other mutants show up, basically guys in black turtlenecks,
right,
chasing him around. They're trying to kill him with machine guns. He breaks into the police armory, and he steals what looks like gas grenades.
Right.
And when Vincent is throwing the gas grenades at these people, he doesn't have much effect on what he's throwing. He's just sort of just lightly tossing them.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like a parody limp-wristed character in that particular scene. I always thought that was odd, that he's not doing any real reason to fight back.
No,
he's going after people with these wooden stakes and driving them through these people's hearts and, you know, and all this other stuff, but when it comes down to fighting people, he was never that great in that particular way they directed him. I don't know why.
No, but that's kind of what I like about the film is everything's a little off and a little odd. As I said, it's in Rome. It's supposed to be America. Nobody speaks English, and the dub is weird. You have Vincent Price playing the action role. You have you have vampires that are basically zombies. everything about
around,
it is isolating and
off-kilter. And they walk around with pieces of stick and Morgan, and they keep banging on the door.
Yeah, no, and it was a direct influence on Night of the Living Dead.
Well, that one was, and another picture, which I read the original book of I Am Legend, and they kept saying he could never find Ben Cortman's body to kill him. According to the book, he was actually living in the house right across the street, and he used to stuff himself up the chimney. Huh. He wasn't out trying to track down Vincent's character. That's how funny it was. That's what the character was. He was actually in the house across. Of course, these guys come in, they just stake him, and at the end of him in the film.
Yeah.
But the film is a little odd. The music's like from Return of the Fly, and everything is just sort of hodgepodge
it's
together.
It's very odd.
In fact, that's the reason why Matheson took his name off the picture and used his pseudonym, Logan Swanson. But the other picture, I was at a convention many years ago where George Romero was at, and they asked him about this thing, about where he got the background for Night of the Living Dead, and he did say it was I Am Legend, Last Man on Earth. But there's another picture, which actually happens to be one of my all-time favorite cheesy films. He also admitted was part of the influence on it. A picture made in 1959 called The Invisible Invaders, starring John Agar and John Carradine. And then he ended up doing his two pictures he did, which were the Dr. Fives films.
Right.
And again, they were done campy. They were not the guys who wrote the script really never wrote a script before in their lives. One of them passed away. The other one's still actually trying to resell it again several times over. And that's Goldman. The other guy wrote The Fossil Man episode of Voyage Above the Sea. But that was one of the campy things for him. That was all done because of the director, Robert Fust. After which point, Vincent's career, he wound up doing his other most famous picture he did was The Theater of Blood, where he met his third wife, Coral Brown. And he got the murder of all the critics of the plays of Shakespeare. And that was his biggest thing, I think, he did as far as at that point. And then he sort of went into just other stuff, The Muppet Show.
Yeah, a lot of television.
He did back in the season, my favorite one, he did the Voyage Above the Sea episode where he's working with this Richard Basehart mannequin puppet. And it's a very comical kind of thing. And the Brady Bunch, and he turned up in a few other shows. And then he made guest appearances here and there on Columbo and the Mod Squad and things of that nature. But after that, he did a picture called Madhouse.
Yeah, I just saw that on. It's on Netflix. I ran into that. I saw it for the first time last Halloween. It's an interesting film.
It's better to see it now because when Orion was it, the Filmways bought out AIP, they tried to release some of these pictures. And they claimed they didn't have the music rights on this, and they redubbed that one over. Actually, now it's been restored with Vincent singing. Actually, one of his last things he filmed, he actually sang at the end. He actually gets put on the makeup of a Tennessee's Peter Cushing at the end of that one, But after that, he did bit parts in here and there. He did a lousy picture called Scavenger Hunt with Tony Randall. He had a bit part in that one. He died off in that one. He did a remake of the old Orson Welles picture called Journey into Fear.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite picture of him as far as his death scene. And I have that in my book. I have all the different death scenes. You have to match the pictures of the death scene. That's with Sam Waterston from Law and Order. And that's one of those early pictures. We're shot in Canada. A lot of different people in it. But at the end, Vincent turns out to be the villain. And Waterston pulls out a flare gun and blows him up. Vincent knew Michael Jackson from the days of when the brothers were working together in the Hollywood Squares in the early 70s. And Vincent got to meet them. He liked them. He was a little kid and stuff and all that stuff. So, you know, they saw each other once in a while. They knew each other in different appearances. When it came time for Michael to go on his own and do Thriller, Quincy Jones, his producer, was looking for a voice, you know, to put in the background on the record album. And Michael knew Vincent, and they suggested it to him. And Vincent said he'd be happy to do it for him because he figured, you know, the kid's going off on his own. And, you know, just to do this rap stuff for the end, of which they only used about half of it. But the rest, I think they re-released on another album. But so he did this horror effort. He said, fine, you know, you do it. I'll do it for you for a favor. Vincent never got paid for that. He did this as a favor for Michael.
Really?
And, you know, he figured, you know, do this fun thing, have fun with the laugh, the whole business thing. You like the kid, you do him a favor. And, of course, what happens? The thing becomes a massive hit. And the thing gets, you know, gold records. And Michael does nothing. Vincent was never paid for this thing. He did it as a favor for him, you know. Mm-hmm. And Vincent showed up once on, I think it was a Tonight Show, and they asked him about that. Because they kept reviving it every year. And he said, you know, I did this thing as, you know, for Michael as a favor and stuff. I thought, at least, you know, they made so much money off this thing. At least they could have thrown him a token something.
Mm-hmm.
Michael found out about it. What did he do? He sent him one of the gold records. Now, a lot of people don't know what a gold record is. You know, it's all being made a gold record. It's a plaque. It's a $40 piece of wood, shellacked, with a little brass plaque on it saying you made 100,000 copies.
Yeah, it's not actually gold.
And the record itself is a vinyl record. Usually, it's a record that it was sitting in the warehouse that didn't sell. They're returns. No, seriously. They are seriously old records. When records were of course, when somebody wasn't popular and the records died, they got stuck with all the pressings. They take them, they spray paint them gold, and they just glue it to the plaque. And they say, it's basically a token, you know, just a monument thing. So he sent that to Vincent, never sent him any money. He got screwed over, he said, by the whole thing. And then, of course, he does the John Landis video with it and everything, and he kept making money off this thing. Vincent got nothing.
Yeah.
So he always felt sort of screwed over this thing, with this Michael Jackson stuff. I mean, he didn't, you know, I don't know what the story was exactly, but but Vincent was always sort of felt sort of shortchanged over the whole thing. He did him a favor, at least, you know, throw him something, send him, you know, some kind of gift or something like that. But, you know, wasn't much of anything that way. Mm. He did a lot of different things. One of the last things he did was a cartoon voices.
Yeah, he did a whole series of Scooby-Doo.
13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo.
13 Ghosts, right.
Playing Vincent Van Gogh. In fact, they brought his character back in a few of the more recent stories, but they have a different guy doing the voice, obviously.
Obviously.
And he also happened to do one of the last things he did was an episode of Tiny Toons.
All right.
When they were doing a takeoff on the Raven. Mm-hmm. Using Sweetie Bird, he was the narrator for the Raven cartoon.
Hmm.
And then the last thing he did theatrically was Edward Scissorhands.
Right, and that's a beautiful scene.
Yeah, and a lot of the things with him in the picture, he was too ill at this point to have done. They cut a lot of the scenes out. They had a lot more plans for him because Tim Burton was a big fan, and he had done that little Vincent picture for him, that little puppet thing he was doing at Disney.
Right.
And you know. He did as much as he could with the show, and then after that, people think that's his last film. He actually made one more picture.
Did he?
For his friend Dennis Hopper. And that was a picture that was made back in the 91. At that time, TNT, Turner Network Television, was doing their own TV movies, so to speak.
Right.
And they did a picture called The Heart of Justice, and which with Edric Stoltz, the guy from the Mask movie, the guy who shares son. And who actually, I remember correctly, played the son of the fly in the second Fly movie they did after Jeff Goldblum.
So he did, yeah.
Yeah. But he was the lead in the picture, and Vincent had a small part in two scenes with basically Dennis Hopper, who was a friend of his. And he did a picture with Dennis Hopper and Jodie Foster a couple of years ago called Backtrack, but playing a gangster. But he was in bits and pieces. And that was his last picture. It was only aired on cable. It came out on video, but it hasn't been seen since. I actually have a copy. I got it from Turner Classics. They actually sent me a screener. Vincent did his last horror pictures, I would say he did, was one that was known as The Offspring, which is now go back to its original title, From a Whisper to a Scream, where he hosts like these three or four horror stories real low budget stuff. It really wasn't great. And the other one he did, which wasn't bad, but it didn't have much of a turnover, was a picture called Dead Heat with Joe Piscopo and Treat Williams.
I remember that.
And Vincent played the guy who ran the car. They supposed he was dead, but actually he was still alive, and he had this machine that would bring people back from the dead. And Darren McGavin was in it, and they got Key Luke, and Charlie Chase's number one son was in it. And, you know, it was a sort of a horror action comedy zombie picture.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't even quite know what to do with it. I think it was produced by Roger Corman's kind of New World, and didn't do all that well for them. The problem was that towards the end of his life, which is when I was working with Vincent on this book, let me go back to the book very quickly with this, is that we were going to work on this book together, and this was 1986. And I said, this was going to take me a while to accumulate all the research material because there wasn't anything to do. I had to go to the research library at Lincoln Center, the Performing Arts Center, and go through books and research films and videos. And he did like 100-something films, and tried almost all of them. I found almost every one of his pictures. There's a couple of old documentaries that are lost. But unfortunately, Vincent's health by this time was already, he was already suffering from Parkinson's.
Right.
As part of it. But his wife, Coral, was suffering from cancer. And then you're talking now, this was 1989 or so. And for the last couple of years of her life, he spent most of his time with his wife. And he wasn't working much. And he was the caretaker for her. And then she eventually died. And that was devastating to him. And he was already, you know, like 80 years old. And he was already suffering all the effects. He was a heavy smoker most of his life. And eventually it's the lung cancer that killed him. So between that and the Parkinson's, his health was at the point he could barely get himself around. He wanted a walker towards the last year of his life. So while we were doing a lot of stuff, I used to call him at his home a lot of times, and we'd talk and chat about different innocuous little things like his fan mail, and we talked about another crazy picture he did called Bloodbath at the House of Death, which is a British comedy, which didn't do well very well for anybody. Starring Kenny Everett and Pamela Stevenson, two big people in England, but the movie never sold well over here. And we talked about this, and we talked about that, and different things. And then, you know, it got to the point he couldn't even continue anymore. So he wished me well with a project of my own. And I went out for the last several years after he passed away and found a lot of material he did, interviews he did back in the 40s and the 50s and even the 1930s about his career and his family and his history and his original encounters with the supernatural when he was a child. And so family stuff. So I was able to incorporate a lot of that stuff into the book from things I couldn't get from him. And the thing about it was, I learned a lot more about him that way too. Is a lot of people don't know a lot of things about him and his family, and I went out and interviewed a lot of other people who work with him to get stories. Like one of the stories about the wonderful comedy he loved called Champagne for Caesar. He did all kind of wacky stuff in his career, and I also happened to get Peter Cushing to write the foreword to my book. I had met Cushing before, and I knew someone who was working with him. And I wrote him a letter. He sent this wonderful open letter to Vincent, which I sent a copy to Vincent before he died, so at least he had a chance to read that, because it was a real particular thing how he, when the Cushing was in America back in 1940-41, and he was even had a small bit part in a Laurel Hardy picture, Cushing, before he went back to England, he went to go see Vincent on Broadway in Angel Street, the Gaslight play, and even then, he was fascinated by the whole thing with the building. He really loved Vincent, and later on, they became very good friends. Vincent and Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee became very good friends. And so, well, they've even worked together with John Carradine in The House of Long Shadows, which was another picture they did together. It wasn't that great a film, but they were all good friends together. They all used to play practical jokes on each other. And, you know, there's a couple of jokes I love, stories. Vincent liked to play jokes on people, and he used to sign other people's names and he used to give autographs because people really didn't recognize him as who he was. He was at an airport in the early 1970s, and this woman comes up to him, and he's sitting there waiting for a plane. He's between flights, and she says, "You're him." And he was reading this. He goes, "What?" He goes, "You're him, aren't you?" He goes, "I'm who?" "You're Boris Karloff." And he goes, "I'm not Boris Karloff." He goes, "Yes, you are. Don't tell me. I know you're Boris Karloff." "I'm not Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff's dead." And then he said, before he had a chance to tell her he was Christopher Lee, she said, "Who the hell are you?" and stormed off. I love that story. That's essentially, I was like, "That was Christopher Lee." Now, the other thing with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, real quick, is Peter Cushing was a very religious man who was totally devoted to his wife. She was a few years older than him. They never had any children, but he was like really sweet, wonderful. They used to call him St. Peter. and everybody loved Peter Cushing. And Lee and Cushing always used to do one of the cartoon impersonations to each other. One would do Yosemite Sam, and the other would Sylvester Puddycat. But that was the two, Cushing and Lee. But Cushing's wife, Helen, died in 1970, 71, and he never wanted acting, and he wanted to die. And always, but they talked him out, and he got back in the pictures, and he lived his life a lot longer, and so he got involved with other things. But every time he would sign a Christmas card or a letter, he'd always sign it, Peter and Helen. He was always waiting to die to join her in heaven. He was a very devout Christian. When the wife died, he sort of gave up his faith because the church didn't help him anything with as far as his faith. But so every time he signed a letter, it was always with that Helen. And one day, he's having a conversation. He's on the phone with Christopher Lee. And Vincent asked, this was towards Peter's end of his life. No, Peter was the other cigarette. I mean, but Vincent asked Christopher Lee, he said, is Peter still thinking that when he dies, he's going to go to heaven and meet his wife? And Chris says, yes, he is. And Vincent says back to him, what if he gets up there and she's out? You know, she wasn't home. And Chris breaks up laughing and says, I'm going to tell you said that. And Vincent says, go ahead. I'm glad you will. So then the story goes is that Vincent found out afterwards. He went and told Cushing the joke. And he said, only Vincent could say that and get away with it. And Chris, you're the only one who could say it to me and get away with it. Because no one else could have. That's how close they were, the three of them.
Well,
that's it. That's the humor. It's just, well, what if he gets up to heaven and she's not there?
Well, as you said, there was nobody who met Vincent who didn't like him. What was your impression of him?
I loved the guy. I mean, he was my idol since I was about 6 years old. I saw House on Haunted Hill on television. There's a funny line that sort of gives you a story about Vincent. It's from Richard Matheson. They were doing a picture in 62 called The Master of the World. It was takeoff on the old Jules Verne story, Robe of the Conqueror. And the co-star in the picture now was Charles Bronson, no more Baczynski. Now he was playing sort of this government agent and stuff, and trying to send Vincent in his flying machine and, you know, to destroy the world. And Bronson hated being in the picture, but he needed the money or something. And Matheson went up to Bronson, and he tried to make friends with the guy, and Bronson wanted nothing to do with him. And then Vincent went to go talk to the guy, and he knew the guy 10 years before in the House of Wax. And Vincent couldn't get through to him for some reason. And he says he couldn't get through to this guy. There was something going on in his head. He didn't like what he was doing. He said because Vincent could make friends with a dead man. Hmm. And in many of his films, he has.
Joel Osner's book, The Price of Fear, is available now on Amazon.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!